If you enjoy our podcast, please consider supporting Glass Tire. All of the money we raise, since we are a nonprofit, goes right back into our coverage of Texas's art and artists. Our coverage is supported thanks to readers and listeners like you. If you would like to contribute, you can do so at glasstire.com/donate. Thanks so much and enjoy today's show. Hello and welcome to Art Dirt. This is a podcast where we at Glass Tire talk about topical art topics. I am Brandon Zeck, and I am sitting in office today with a man who really needs no introduction, Paul Hester. Welcome to Art Dirt.
Thank you, Brandon. It's wonderful to visit your 12th story hideaway.
Oh, it makes us sound so fancy.
You are fancy.
Well, I'm so glad you're on the podcast today. You have a show that's up right now at Andrew Durham Gallery. You're a Houston and Fayetteville based photographer. A little back and forth between the two, I guess, nowadays. A lot of our listeners in Houston will be familiar with your name and your work. In case they're not, we ran a review of your exhibition at Andrew Durham Gallery about a week ago. So we'll make sure to include that in like the link to the reading list in this podcast. We also, I was reading back today before you came in, we had a really great profile of you back in 2019 written by Gene Fowler that is, I feel like, really informative and kind of captures the thrust of some of your work that our listeners can check out if they want to. But I want to jump in and just kind of go from the beginning. How did you end up in Houston? So you were born in Nashville and you grew up in North Texas and Arkansas, right?
Right.
How did that happen? How did y'all make it to Texas? Why Texas and Arkansas?
Both my parents grew up in North Texas. My father wanted to be a journalist. He was going to college in Chicago, and he got a job in Nashville, Tennessee, with the Methodist Publishing House, as in of the Methodist Church. His father had been a minister. My mother's father had been a minister, and my father was not going to be a minister. He was going to be a journalist. So I showed up. And for
that's a good way to say you were born. I showed up.
It felt that way. It felt that way because for some reason they decided to get out of town, and we did a loop through Chicago for my dad to finish his degree, and then he took over a church in Cattle Mills, Texas, and continued his education at Perkins School of Theology at SMU. To become a minister. So he had decided to join the family business. And he did that for about, well, it seemed like it was my whole life. And up to that point, it had been. But when I calculated it, he didn't stay a minister that long. And when I was 15, he left the ministry and we moved to where my mother's parents lived in Arkansas. So that's how I did do 3 years of high school in Arkansas. And as I was getting a lot of pressure from my grandmother. She would tell my fortune, and she would stroke the palm of my hand and say, "Oh, Paul, you're going to be such a good preacher." But I think my father, without coming right out and saying, "Don't do this," he said, "I think you would really like to study architecture." Of course, he wished he had studied architecture.
Uh-huh. It's still a projection. It's just a different kind of projection.
Yes, yes. And I applied to schools, and Rice had the most scholarship because as a preacher's family, you don't have any money. So I came to Rice in 1966, studied architecture for 3 years. And then that's when the Menils shifted from their support from St. Thomas to Rice. And suddenly, the arts were the hottest thing on campus. Mm-hmm. The art in the age of the machine, mm-hmm. and lots of other shows. Just amazing.
Yeah. Art and Age of the Machine was just was a major show that that debuted, I think, at MoMA, right, that Dominique DeMenil organized to bring to Houston.
Yes. It may have originated in Sweden. Mm-hmm. I think I remember something about that. So they set up the Institute for the Arts on the Rice campus. Had a print club where people could you could borrow prints, rent to buy sort of thing. They were cultivating, yeah. They were creating
collectors. Yeah.
And the shows were beautiful, provocative, and very free form in that wonderful space that was we all call the Art Barn. Because it was one clear span. Mrs. DeMenil could have those walls moved around in any kind of configuration. I graduated finally and left town and went to graduate school. And when I came back, I was working at the media center next door. And because I had a 4x5 and knowledge of how to use it, I had some friends who worked for the foundation for the institute, mm-hmm. I started getting to do photography of installations. And these were Mrs. DeMenil's designs.
Yeah.
I remember photographing a show that had a Magritte in it, and she had placed sand with a curve serpentine kind of border containing the sand and some rocks and a plant and stuff. And so I was struggling with my 4x5 in the upside down mode, and behind me, I hear this voice saying, in a French accent, which I will not attempt, it looks really good from right here. And so she was right. She knew what she wanted. And so I feel like my interest in photography was to show the world the way I saw it. But I also liked trying to translate what other people saw. Photography is a great tool for doing all kinds of things. And I really enjoyed, and I still enjoy working for architects because I do like buildings. My father was right. I do like that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. My favorite thing about them is they don't move and they don't talk back. So I can wait all day as the earth turns and the sunlight changes. Mm-hmm. But all of that has changed, too, as we moved up with iPhones and Instagram, the kinds of photographs, the way photographs look, the way photographs are used in social media. Much different from when I was training and learning about photography and Walker Evans, John Sharkowski at the Museum of Modern Art. Those were the kinds of standards that we were presented with. I studied with Jeff Winningham at Rice as an undergraduate. That approach to photography, I think is still valid. I don't think we will ever be able to throw that away. We look at photographs now differently. We will say, is it real or is it Memorex or is it Adobe Photoshop?
Yeah.
But as evidence, photography, we all use that. We rely on that in so many different ways. But I think we've expanded,
yeah.
So that we can accept now. I think
all the different modes.
Yeah, I think people are smart, visually smart. We may not be so literate as we once were, mm-hmm. but visually, what we like, and a variety of people. I was very lucky to be able to teach photography at Rice for 15 years, and even though I had my own axe to grind about the way that I liked photography, I learned how that generation, a couple of generations or age of kids, mm-hmm. students were, what they wanted to show and what they were seeing. So,
how do you like photography? Like, what to you makes a good picture?
That is the perennial question,
yeah.
Right? And I can use as an example some students who would say, well, you know, the rule of thirds. Mm-hmm. And so I looked up the rule of thirds online and when it was devised in maybe the 16th century. So I would say to students, it was a good rule then, but it was a rule that was made after the fact. People looked at paintings and they analyzed them and they said, oh, I like this one. This is good. It gives me a calm feeling. Oh, look, third, one third, one third, one third. Mm-hmm. We don't live in the 16th century anymore. Yeah. Maybe sometimes we have the need for calmness and serenity, but that's not the only emotion or stuff of life going on right now. So maybe the rule of thirds is just one of your tools in your bag of tricks, and you don't judge every photograph if it breaks that rule. Because we went through modernism, that the whole thing was rejecting, just like a previous generations. You look at some things now. I looked at a lot of architecture. I still love architecture. We had a field trip when I was in architecture school. They took us as sophomores. They took us to Chicago, and they showed us all the really new stuff. And I loved all the new stuff. I didn't like the old stuff too much, you know, where skyscrapers were invented. But a few years later, I went back on my own. All that stuff that had been so new and exciting in 1968 looked very stale and kind of clunky, sterile. And the old stuff was just beautiful. I was there on a job, and after I finished the job, I took my 4x5 out, and I photographed the remnant of Louis Sullivan's arch. I think the Art Institute bought it, and they saved it from a theater. But it's just this extraordinarily beautiful arch with subtle carvings and, you know, how we destroy history. And thank God for photography. Every day I thank God for photography.
Well, that rule of thirds comparison is really interesting, because also, like, not just that it goes back that far historically, but that photography wasn't a thing back then. So, I mean, you know, not that you can't apply concepts across artistic media, but at the same time, to try and translate what made a good Renaissance painting to what makes a good photograph, in some cases, yes, it's probably true. But working in photography, I feel like it's an interesting medium because it hasn't been taken seriously for that long. Like, that's just kind of the reality. Like, if we're looking at other things like paint on, like pigment on a canvas, you know, like digital art, photography, and video art are really kind of the new kids on the block. So everyone's still trying to suss out what it is. And that, I mean, that makes for a complex way to create work in that medium, I feel like.
There are so many different ways to slice the analytic tools of looking at any human activity or resulting in an object. Photographs are really wonderful for documenting process. I have several series where I just go back to the same object, the same place, to see it in different times of day or night, to see it over a period of time, and how my own attitude changes toward that time. Yes, we can use all those analytical tools, but they're just tools like anything else. And if you take a valuable rock and you smash it to see what it's made of and what makes it so good, and then it's smashed. So you've gained some knowledge and hopefully a lesson to don't do that again. It was a question a lot. I was very lucky. Students nowadays, I hear people dissing students and young people, but hopefully they're going to get out and vote. They know it's their life. It's their planet. So they have beliefs and attitudes, and they want to understand. So they ask hard questions. and what makes a photograph good, for me, is different for every person.
Yeah.
We all have had so many different kinds of experiences that sometimes a work will just pierce my heart, and I don't even know why. Mm-hmm. It just mesmerizes me. I'm transfixed. And then you can walk by it later in a different frame of mind, and it's not even there.
Yeah.
So I don't know. Is it because we study art in school that we overanalyze it? One of the things I really liked about Ronnie Yates's writing about my show was that he was looking at it from historical point of view. He was looking at it with knowledge of what that statue was in the back of one of the photographs or in a couple of the different photographs. So that's a way in which an individual's knowledge of the world around us, the context, influences, contributes to what we learn about the work, what we feel. Feelings are so slippery, and they're fleeting, and they come and they go. And I don't think we're really helped to believe in feelings. Feelings are like intuitive, and when you really like something, you want to figure out why.
Yeah.
I think. I mean, maybe it's just having been brought up in the church by ministers that the words and the explanations for miracles and all the things that are part of religion, the things that are basically ineffable, ephemeral, but people have spent a lot of effort trying to pin them down. I was at lunch with some friends today, and we started talking about the King James Version of the Bible. This is a wonderful group of Rice students that we've all known each other for 50 or 60 years. And one was saying, well, the original King James Version was beautiful poetry. And then I said, yeah, but, you know, the people that wrote the original Bible, they didn't even know English.
Mm-hmm. So someone turned it into beautiful poetry. Or interpreted it to be beautiful poetry.
I think that's exactly.
What verb is it?
Brandon, that's it. That's exactly the question about art.
Yeah.
For what's a cool thing for one person, the next person doesn't give beans about what's cool. They want something that matches their tradition, that the criteria that they've established. So, but our criteria are always changing.
Let me ask you this. I hadn't really thought about this and through this angle until now, so give me a second as I work it out. Do you think that there's a lower barrier for photography than some other art forms? And I ask with the context of, like, what we hear all the time as people who are engaged in art and visit museums and know people who are not art people, it's always, well, I don't understand art. Like, I don't understand what art means. We don't say the same thing about TV shows generally, or movies, or music, or other types of kind of creative expression. And I feel like oftentimes that reaction to I don't understand art is like paintings or abstract art or things that are a little less, I'm going to use the word accessible, but it's not the right word, but less accessible than photography. And I think maybe that's changed because, of course, photography in general is more accessible now than it ever has been. But what do you think about the barrier for entry with viewers of photography? Do you think it's different than other types of art? Do you think it's changed over the years? How do you think about that as an artist in terms of allowing people to bring what they bring to your photos?
I can't stop them from bringing what they're going to bring.
Of course.
But that is a smart aleck answer. I think with painting and sculpture, remember when museums were called fine arts?
Yeah.
So fine was to distinguish it from folk art, from common, people. So
from photography at some point.
No, not even from photography,
yeah.
Because photography was not in the door. It was commercial.
Yeah.
You know, no one really knew who Alfred Stieglitz was and didn't care. Poor man. he's just the husband of George O'Keefe,
mm-hmm.
who never moved to New Mexico. He never visited New Mexico. Now, that is one mark against him for sure, especially if George O'Keefe's there, but still the landscape. I think when someone says, I don't understand it, I'm assuming that in their mind is that there is a standard, an idea that someone else has an understanding, and they don't get it. So they're admitting a little bit of inferiority.
Yeah.
And they're critiquing it. It's the anti-intellectualism that's in general. That it's about, if there are ideas about it, and I don't know about the ideas, we know that reading, knowing, listening to what the artist says, we will always have to be suspicious and question that. But there are people who devote their lives to telling us what they feel about it. And as a child of the ministry, that's a new phrase I just thought of.
A child of the ministry.
A child of the ministry. I believed in authority a great deal.
Yeah.
I was afraid of the authority. I did not want to mess around. I did not want to be punished. So I don't think I'm unique in that situation. That's what authority does. It exercises its power over us. And there is a power when you have a gajillion-dollar museum that looks like the Emerald City, that no matter how many friendly, family-oriented kind of activities they can do, it's still based on a premise of exclusion and privilege. Okay, and so someone who says, well, I want to know more, but yes, the museums hire people to translate and help, but the general look, and let's say we do get our information from the visual, is look but don't touch.
Yeah.
And we are the keepers.
Yeah.
We are the people with the money, so we buy what you're supposed to worship and revere. And I think even times critics are bought by them. I mean, and that's in every field. Yeah. You know,
there's always a kowtowing to power in some way, shape, or
form.
Oh,
man.
Yeah.
You just said it. That's a great image. Kowtowing. Wow. So photography was, I think it was a stroke of genius on the part of William Agee and Ann Tucker to say, let's put photography in the museum. Of course, they believed in photography, and Anne had a good history and studied with a lot of important people, made her own photographs in the beginning, that this is a way that, and we do it on, well, we do monographs, sure, but we do them on themes too. The war, wow.
Yeah, war and photography, a major show that the Museum of Fine Arts Houston did maybe back in 2012 or thereabouts, that Ann Tucker, I believe, co-organized, right? With, there's probably another curator whose name I'm forgetting. Forgive me, whoever you are. But Ann Tucker, the legendary Museum of Fine Arts Houston photo curator who was there for, I mean, dozens of years.
For not long enough.
Who built that collection.
She was not there long enough. She still had contributions. But the way that photography could and does address subject matter that is accessible. Mm-hmm. So photography has subject matter. Paintings have subject matter, but people don't talk about the subject matter. They talk about the formal qualities.
Yeah.
But I think all of that has changed too. And the interactions between all the media has been much to their each field's benefits, I think.
Yeah.
I studied in graduate school with a couple of different people, and one of them was Aaron Siskin, who had moved from being a strictly documentary photographer to being an abstract photographer, doing photographs of shapes, basically forms. And he hung out in New York with the abstract expressionist. And I had read about that and knew that he was there. And I had sort of made the assumption that I think a lot of people had, or not that a lot of people thought about it, but as a photographer, I wondered, because his documentary photographs, he was part of the Film and Photo League, which was one of Ann Tucker's early research projects. It started as a communist organization. It was publicizing social activism. And he started there, and he did documentations of Harlem. He was also a high school English teacher, and he was really good at organizing other photographers. So he had this group of other photographers working with him on the Harlem Project. When he got a teaching job in teaching art photography, he was in Chicago, and he organized architectural documentation projects. But I saw a show in the Museum of Contemporary Art in L.A., MoCA. My wife's from L.A., and we go every year at least once. And this was a great show with Franz Kline's paintings and Aaron Siskind's photographs. And it was beautiful and very imaginative for someone to exhibit these. Aaron made decent-sized prints, 16 by 20s, but then Franz Kline's paintings were huge. But it was exhibited well, presented very well, and they had dates on them. And what I love to read the dates about when did they make this, how old were they when they made it, when was it made in relative to someone else's studies. And so I really saw that exhibit as confirmation that they were in conversation, that Aaron was not just borrowing their formal qualities, that the belief in the abstract they shared. It was a wonderful experience.
Let me bounce off that and take it back to you. So thinking about dates and how old you were when you made work, and thinking about, 55, 60 years of making photographs.
That's just what's in the show. There's more.
You know that. Oh, there's so much more. But if what you're doing with photography is showing people how you see the world, or showing other people, or showing the way the world is seen by other people, kind of a combination of those two things, how you see the world changes throughout your life as you get older, as you gain more experiences, as you have more life experiences, you go through tragedies, you go through happiness, as you kind of take all of the rides that life offers up. Are you conscious of a way that either your work and the way it looks, or the way that you approach it, or both, have changed as you've gone through life?
Yes.
How?
Well, you itemize many of those factors that influence changes. And when I see a work of art, a photograph, a drawing, painting, I like to know the date. I like to know how old the artist was when they made that. And Rembrandt's, to me, his self-portraits are a great example of how much I learn from seeing his image of himself, the young, debonair, a lot of flair, and as he ages, and then he's not pretending.
Yeah, he's in his painting cap at the end.
Yes.
Or he's in his smock. Yeah.
Yes. Nothing to hide behind. This is it. And my interest in photography has been intuitive. I will photograph something that catches my eye, like walking into your office here, and seeing you far across the big room in a small room, that visual containment. Mm-hmm. It's all visual, but the visual is informed by what I know about you, what happened to me before I came through the door, paying the guy in the parking lot. All these things we're just carrying them with us all the time, and we forget those things. But the changes that have happened as working as a commercial photographer, as a professional photographer, as making my living taking photographs for other people, learning what their criteria are. I didn't understand that in the beginning when I started out. I learned to ask questions. What are you trying to show here? What's this going to be for? Simple, basic questions, which all of us in our interactions with other people, we just assume that other people can read our minds and that they know what we're thinking. Mm-hmm. And when you take a photograph, then if it looks different from what people have in their minds, the best people will come back and negotiate and say, this is not exactly what I had in mind. I would like this and this. And so it was a process of give and take. Not everybody has learned how to negotiate, and so they just turn you off and they never call you again. But learning from other people was hard at first because I wanted to be I'd gone to graduate school. I know what's good.
I know how to make a photograph.
Yes.
Yeah.
But I don't know how to make the photograph for you. Yeah. And that's when I begin to, I think, understand that different people have different criteria. And I could make a wonderful photograph that satisfies me, but it's not going to be for the other person. And trying to convey that with students over 15 years about what are your values, it's really, I mean, it's kind of a, my mom was an elementary school teacher, and I would always like to kind of pick books off her bookshelf. And one of them that I really loved was called Value Clarification.
That's such a technical but accurate term for what that is.
Well, it was so amazing to me that people were studying that and thinking about that. One, they're thinking about their values, not that you just have your values, but you form them. They're always in the process of, and so we're talking about how do you know if art's good or not? Well, does it meet your criteria? Well, what are your criteria? What are your values? And my values changed a lot. It depended on who was hiring me, who was commissioning me. Sometimes if you're lucky, you get a commission that no strings attached. Mm-hmm. But that's rare. Yeah. You know, I think even Matisse had strings attached for the chapel design. You know, I don't know about Ellsworth Kelly, but architects had to contend with religious mm-hmm. tradition and the ceremonies of the church.
The basic needs of people.
Well, not always.
Well, not all. I was going to say, unless you're Frank Lloyd Wright and can just get away with, you know, this is your house and you're going to like it. But yeah. No, that compromise is always really interesting between people who have a creative output as a job, who have clients.
Yes.
Yeah.
And I think it's not fair to say that that's not creative.
Yeah.
It's also not fair to say that it's art, because art is a different thing. Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of objects, processes, performances, they do not speak to me now. Mm-hmm. And I'll be 76 next month, so I'm not the target audience. It's someone else who is listening to that. And if I'm lucky, or if I think, let me listen to it a while, if it's music or if it's whatever, watch it, think about it, you can figure out something that maybe, okay, you know, there's something there. Mm-hmm. But it's not for me right now at this time. I think about that a lot in books and what books I'd like to read or listen to. And I think all of these things where someone has a point of view. And so when you're working for someone else on a commission, it's not singularly your point of view, or at least I was never operating at that level. Yeah. I was working, well, I had many really good clients who considered that we were collaborating, and they would listen to me and I would listen to them, and we would, if we were using the 4x5, we'd move the camera back and forth and try to pick one. But now with digital, we'd take one over here and one over there and one over there and look at it back later in the studio. The questions of what works and what doesn't, those aren't written in stone, I don't think. We are taught in school by art historians who have an artist, who are teachers, who have their own criteria. Some of them present it as, this is the way it is. You like it or get out. But those are not the best. I mean, I think some people flourish or, let's say, benefit from that approach. I never really tried to teach that way because I had my own doubts. So I wanted to convey my doubts without avoiding, I mean, I would not hide my preferences. Yeah. I would say what I liked, but not that it's the only way, only one, one way only.
If anyone in Houston has seen you around, they could recognize you in part because you're just photographing all the time. I mean, you're not carrying like a DSLR or a film camera around your neck all the time, but with your phone, the very first time I met you, you were just taking photographs of everything. You walked into the office today, just like you said. You walked in, got inside the door, immediately pulled out your phone and took a photograph. Your propensity to photograph, obviously it's because you see the world and you're translating it and you are an artist. But what is that doing for you're taking a photograph right now. What is that doing for you on your own end? Are you just framing things constantly? Are these almost steadies? Are these snapshots of your life? Is it an obsession? Like how do these images work for you?
Well, the answer is all of the above. I recently took a writing workshop through Inprint. And we had a wonderful teacher named Rosa Gonzalez. And she set up
One of our contributors, I think.
In fact, I had been thinking about taking a writing workshop, and I opened up the Glass Tire email, and there was a picture of this beautiful woman who was teaching a writing workshop. And the things that she said and what she talked about, I said, it's a nonfiction writing class. We're not learning how to write fiction. But although she says there's always some fiction and nonfiction. Yeah. But in the process of taking that class, I started writing some about my photographs. And I learned a lot from everyone in that class. Rosa created a really supportive, safe environment that we could all share some intense feelings. It was a really good process. We did it one semester back in the fall, and we all said, please do it again. So we did another one in the spring. In that workshop, based on some of my writing, describing some of my habits of photographing, I was convinced what they were saying was true, that I was using the camera to hide behind. I was protecting myself. Mm-hmm. I was 6 feet social distancing. Yeah. So I resisted that a long time. One of the other people in the workshop quoted Susan Sontag's thing about, you know, that photography, when you're taking pictures, you're not experiencing it. And I've always disagreed with that. I agreed with many things that Sontag said in her book on photography. But I contend that taking a picture is also an experience. But I've had some dear friends from a long time ago say, no, you're not participating. You're having your own experience separate from the rest of us. But we're glad you did because now we have photographs of it.
Yeah.
So I have actually missed something by photographing, but I feel like I've gained something else. So my first serious photography was in high school, working on the yearbook. I like the history element, documentary. And partly what I do is just what I did. I want to remember this emotion, this sensation of the first time of walking in and seeing you at your keyboard in this little room. First, it's a dark rectangle, and then there's the bright little window behind that. So I do, when I was in graduate school, I was going through intense confusion of, I had come from a documentary background tradition, and I was studying with a bunch of people who wanted to be the next Edward Weston. It was very confusing. But there was a wonderful man who taught at RISD's Rhode Island School of Design, taught in the humanities, the history, art history. So he would come to our work, our classes sometimes, and he'd say, well, Paul, yeah, you can be so totally obsessed with form that you forget everything else. But then he took a pencil and he drew this zigzag diagonal line back and forth. And he said, but that feeling of just drawing that is different from if I just draw a straight line without doing that. And so both the muscle memory, the muscle action, and the emotion produces a different form. Mm-hmm. And so form is important. Yeah. And I was really close to just saying to all these other aspiring art photographers that what they were saying was just bullshit, that they were just only talking about form and it had no human meaning to me. Mm-hmm. So Barry Kirschenbaum was a man who helped me on that, just that simple two lines of, yeah, form is significant. For me, it's not the only thing. And we see a lot of art now that is, I mean, always has been, that the form, and so it finally, for me, is dry. Yeah. It doesn't connect to me. And so really, for me, a photograph that puzzles me, that I mean, there are photographs that I look at and I say, oh, that just feels right. But there are others that bug the hell out of me. And those are the ones that stick with me.
Yeah.
And so I don't think you can judge immediately.
Yeah.
I think it takes a long time.
It's that feeling.
And the feelings change.
Yeah.
During one photo fest many years ago, Lee Friedlander exhibited his photographs at the Museum of Natural Science. And these were of the desert scene. He had taken he had stopped using 35 millimeter, not stopped, but he had shifted and concentrating on the square format. And he had gone out in New Mexico and Arizona, I think maybe traveled with Frederica Hunter and some other people from Houston and from his own New York world. And those prints were hard to look at. They were so brittle. And he never shot digital. He was shooting film and beautifully developed film, usually a tonal range like, sensual, soft, but in focus. And I couldn't look at those pictures. I was just, you know, there are artists who challenge you. You've respected their work. You follow them along. And suddenly they tell you this curve. And you say, what the hell?
Yeah.
He's lost it. I don't know what's going on. But, of course, you have to trust this person. And you say, okay, I'll look at it again. Yeah. And eventually I went out and bought the book and looked at it a lot more. And of course, he's exactly right. That's what the experience is in the desert. It's not an Edward Weston tonal range or an Ansel Adams tonal range. It's that, I mean, he would say, I'm sure, that there was tone where it needed to be. Mm-hmm. So that's an example for me of how I've changed at different times of liking someone's work and then not liking it and then catching up later.
Yeah.
So when Andrew Durham called me and said he wanted to put photographs up for PhotoFest, did I have any photographs?
Do you have any photographs, Paul? That's the no offense to Andrew, that's the stupidest question to ask Paul. Because if the answer is no, then something's wrong.
Well, Well, I had gotten to know Andrew through my friend Jeff Jennings, who showed some work there. And Andrew has a sense of humor, like very,
yes, he does.
Very straight. He just says, you know, maybe. It's been a great experience working with him and with Bob Russell there. They run a great show, and it's a beautiful space. It's really, the light is wonderful, and they are so supportive, and they throw great parties. Yeah. Just get on their mailing list, go to the openings. Andrew likes to throw a party.
And your show's up until, it was recently extended, so it's now up until?
May 18th.
May 18th.
Whole nother month. No more excuses to say, I haven't seen it yet. So I've been cutting people some slack. I say, either you went to see it and you don't like it and you're not going to tell me that, or you just haven't gotten around to it yet. And either way, you're just avoiding me now. Mm-hmm. I get it. It's an intense show. It's hard to look at. And I've been really supported by several people. Glass Tire has been very supportive, you and Gabe and Ronnie. That helps a lot because you have the euphoria of, oh my God, we finally got it up on the walls. It's there. We made the edit. My wife, Lisa Hardaway, is my best curator, and talked me through what I was trying to do. She was the primary curator on the show that you and Christina reviewed
at the Rice Media Center in 2019. Yeah,
way back then, because I was paralyzed and procrastinating. And
well, when you title a show 50 years of work, I mean, yes, those are the emotions that would come along with that.
Yeah, so I topped it this time with 55 years. That's been about 5 years since then.
Yeah.
I did do a show once. The local chapter of the American Institute of Architects honored me with the Artist of Their Year. And so I called it Doing Time in Houston.
That's good.
And it was showing befores and afters of a lot of projects that I'd photographed over a period of time. So literally time passing. And to me, that's one of the wonderful things. There's nothing better than an old photograph for me, an old gelatin silver print. Yeah. Most of the prints in the show are gelatin silver. They were made within at least 6 months or a year of the time of their making. So when you see the date, it says 72. The print was made within that general time. Yeah. So those are vintage prints.
Vintage. On that note, I think we're going to wrap it up.
Oh, wait, I've got more to say.
I know you have more to say, and that's the problem. I could sit here and talk to you for the next 2 hours.
We have great conversations. I always am happy when I see you at an opening, like at the car wash.
Yep, you too.
Yeah, thank you very much, Brandon.
Thanks for being here, Paul. And like we said, you have until May 18th to see the show at Andrew Durham Gallery. There's also a contemporaneous show on view by Sarah Sudhoff at the gallery, so you get a double bang for your buck. There's a lot going on right now. A lot of things are wrapping up. A lot of new things are opening for the spring. So check out Glass Tire's event listings. And until then, go see some art.
This podcast was recorded by Glass Tire and edited by William Saradet. Copyright Glass Tire 2024.